Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome and thank you for joining us for today's webinar, Protecting Residents from Financial Exploitation, How Ombudsman Can Use the New Consumer Financial Protection Bureau Guide in Their Work. This is Aaliyah Murphy, Associate Long-Term Care Ombudsman Program and Policy with the National Long-Term Care Ombudsman Resource Center. We are going to cover a lot of information today, so I'd like to review a few housekeeping tips and then get started. During the webinar, all lines are muted. If you have a question, please post your question using the chat feature on the left side of your screen. You will have an opportunity to ask questions of our speakers at the end of the webinar, and when it is time for the Q&A, we will ask you to send us your questions via chat or raise your hand, and we will tell you how to unmute your line before speaking. Also, as you may have heard a moment ago, this webinar is being recorded. The webinar recording and PowerPoint slides will be sent to you via email and posted on the NORC website, www.ltcombudsman.org, in the near future. So the purpose of today's webinar is to give you an overview of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau's new guide for assisted living and nursing facilities entitled Protecting Residents from Financial Exploitation, a Manual for Assisted Living and Nursing Facilities. The guide was developed to help operators and staff protect residents from financial exploitation through prevention and early intervention, and outlines ways to create awareness and develop policies and practices to protect residents. In addition to enhancing ombudsman advocacy skills regarding the warning signs of financial exploitation and learning about effective strategies to prevent and respond to such abuse, ombudsmen can share the guide and tips and information included with facility staff. Our first speaker today will be Naomi Karp, who is a policy advisor with the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, or CFPB, Office of Older Americans. Naomi will provide background on CFPB and the new guide and detail how long-term care ombudsman can use this new resource to work with facilities to combat financial exploitation. Then we will hear from Iris Freeman with the William Mitchell College of Law, who will detail the process in which Minnesota developed a state-specific manual in 2010 and will provide tips on how to replicate that process in your state. Lastly, Lisa Schifferly with the Federal Trade Commission will give a brief overview of a new consumer education campaign aimed at older adults around the issue of scam prevention. Now I'm going to turn it over to Naomi for our first presentation.
Great. Thank you so much, Aaliyah, and to all of you for being out there. I'm excited to do this webinar. We did a webinar earlier this year with Consumer Voice and the Ombudsman Resource Center, and it was really terrific. So it's great to have the opportunity to do this again. So I'm just going to go quickly through the first couple of slides. So let's go to the next slide. This is just a disclaimer that I have to make as a federal government employee, that this is me speaking, and I'm a representative of the Bureau, but it doesn't constitute advice from the Bureau. So let's move on. What we are going to do during the webinar is we have some poll questions for you. These are partly just to make sure that you're awake, since it is at least on the East Coast, the middle of the afternoon, and we want to keep everything lively, but we'll also be really interested to hear your answers, and it will inform our conversation. So let's start with the first poll question. And so I wanted to know who is in our audience. So please tell us whether you work for a local ombudsman program, a state ombudsman office, another state agency, or some other type of organization. Okay, so pretty much what I expected, almost all of you, 67 of you, are working for a local program. Then we have a handful of people in the state ombudsman's office or other agency. So this is really great. That means that most of you are really out there in the field going out to facilities, and we hope and we think that the guide will be useful for you. Also, I did want to mention that we certainly had input from Ombudsman Program and from the Ombudsman Program Support Office at the Administration on Aging in creating it. So you have had some input and you've helped us. So let me tell you briefly about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, because many people out around the country don't know about it, and we're a new agency. We are a federal financial regulatory agency. We were created coming out of the financial crisis and the Dodd-Frank Act. And the agency launched 3 years ago in July of 2011. You can see on your screen our mission. It has to do with making sure that consumer financial products and services work for Americans. And we do that in several different ways. We educate people, and that is where my office, which I'll tell you about a little bit more, the Office for Older Americans, comes in. We also have enforcement attorneys that can bring cases against offending marketers of consumer financial products and services. We have a research unit. We put out regulations and so forth. But let's get to the next slide so we can talk a little bit about why I'm at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and that's because by statute we have an Office for Older Americans. We have one page in the Dodd-Frank Act, which is probably thousands of pages. Our mission is to help consumers. The statute says 62 and over, but we generally just look at older adults to get the financial education and training they need. And we've really expanded that also to be sure that we give the education and training needed to professionals, stakeholders, advocates, family members, caregivers, all of the different entities who would interact with and support older adults. And there are kind of two buckets of issues. The first is preventing unfair, deceptive, and abusive practices aimed at seniors. And we put elder financial exploitation, regardless of the source, in that category. And then the second bucket of issues are things around making sure that people have a secure later life financially. So helping people make decisions around retirement, around getting the right place to live, the right insurance, and so forth in their later years. We like to say we're the only office in the federal government specifically dedicated to the financial health of seniors. We have a booming staff of about 9 people at this point, so you can see we have a lot of work to do. Moving on to the next slide, this is just a screenshot of the Older Americans page on the CFPB's website, which is www.consumerfinance.gov. If you look at the Older Americans page, it will give you some basic information about what we do, and then it will also link to some of our publications and resources, and we'll get back to those later in the presentation. So now let's have another poll question. And I think some of these answers of some of these poll questions may have been shortened a little bit, but I'll read out the full question. So who might try to exploit older adults financially? And we have a number of choices here as answers. Pick all that apply based on stories that you've heard and cases that you've encountered. So is it family members, is it paid caregivers, financial advisors, new best friends, home repair contractors, members of the clergy, long-distance scam artists like Jamaican lottery scammers? What do you think? Okay, you're all really quick off the mark, and you've answered it pretty much the way I would, which is really all of the above. You may not have heard stories of all of these, but those stories are out there. Unfortunately, the harm is coming from a lot of different places around our country, and so we have to get prepared to deal with that. So let's move on to just some basic background on elder financial exploitation and what do we mean by that. Many of you may be familiar with this, but we just want to make sure we're all on the same page about some background information. And before we get into those bullets on the slide, I just wanted to read you a couple of case vignettes that we've included in the manual that we're talking about today, just to give a little flavor to what we're talking about. So Mr. R, age 77, suffered from Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases, diabetes, and other ailments. His pastor persuaded the former church deacon to grant him authority to manage his finances and care decisions. The result of this misplaced trust included 130 ATM withdrawals from Mr. R's bank account, 9 months of unpaid nursing home bills, and the threat of discharge for nonpayment. The victim died at his facility. The perpetrator was charged and convicted of financial exploitation of a vulnerable adult. And here's the second case. Mr. C was charged with stealing more than $315,000 from his elderly mother's retirement accounts over the course of 5 years. According to the criminal complaint, he was named as his mother's agent under a power of attorney. Prudent investment and funds from long-term care insurance should have been sufficient to cover his mother's care for the rest of her life. Yet, she was evicted from her assisted living facility for non-payment. In the process of searching for a less expensive facility, another of the victim's children uncovered the theft. Over the years, the vast majority of withdrawals had been made at a casino. So these are just two of the many, many types of things that can happen, unfortunately, to older adults. And these are real cases. All of the cases in the manual are real cases. I'm sure you don't doubt that because you see them. But they're representative. They show the threat of, that you may lose your home because of financial exploitation. You may die while this is happening. And it may be a very close family member, especially a child who may be perpetrating this, among others. So there are different definitions of elder financial exploitation, and frequently you'll find those in state law, either in your criminal code or in your adult protective services code. But we just have a basic one here. It's very broad. Illegal or improper use of an older adult's funds, property, or assets. Elder financial exploitation is the most common form of elder abuse, but as you probably know, only a small fraction of incidents are reported. One study showed that almost $3 billion in losses occurred in the year 2010. Another study showed that 5.2% of people over age 60 are financially mistreated by a family member. And the cases really are under the radar. There was a study in New York State, a very extensive study, that showed that only one out of every 44 cases actually reached the attention of Adult Protective Services or other victim services agencies. So the cases you heard in the example, those were cases that came out, that were reported, and that were prosecuted, but many, many, the great majority, are not. Obviously, we talked about perpetrators. There's a broad variety of them. Older adults are often attractive targets because they have significant assets or they have a lot of home equity. Many of them, their homes are paid off. They've owned them for many years, and so there's a lot of money to get out of that. And why are older adults vulnerable? Well, lots of reasons, and we list them here, isolation. I want to highlight cognitive decline, and we'll talk about that a little bit more. Health problems, bereavement, and so forth. So let's go on to another poll question. And now we're getting more specifically to the topic of financial exploitation of residents in assisted living and nursing facilities. Why is financial exploitation a big threat to residents of assisted living and nursing facilities? One, they're especially vulnerable to abuse because many have cognitive impairments. Two, many have a family member or friend managing their money, and those people have an opportunity to steal. Three, if someone steals their money, their rent or monthly fees might not get paid. Four, facility staff might take their money or possessions. Or five, all of the above. Ah, I see that almost all of you are saying all of the above, and I would have to agree with that. So now let's talk a little bit about the CFPB's initiative and what we were trying to do when we created this national manual. And I should have said earlier, you'll hear in a little while from Iris Freeman in Minnesota. Iris was really the person who spearheaded the development of a similar manual in Minnesota, and that came first. And I was familiar with that manual and with Iris, and I thought it would be a terrific help to people all around the country if we could take that state-specific manual and scale it up to a national manual. So just want to give kudos to Iris on that. And she'll, even though it's a little bit backwards, after we talk about the national manual, she'll tell you a little bit about the process in Minnesota and about how you can adapt it for a state. So clearly we've talked a little bit about older adults being targets and that the threats come from trusted people. Sometimes they come from strangers, and sometimes it comes from staff or intruders in the facility. So why is cognitive impairment such a big issue here? Well, as people have some cognitive decline, whether it be normal changes of aging or development of mild cognitive impairment and then full-blown Alzheimer's or another dementia, financial capacity, that ability to handle money and property and calculate and so forth on a day-to-day basis is the first type of capacity to decline. So frequently we see people who still look very put together, they're dressing fine, they're going about their daily activities, but actually their finances are in disarray because they really can't manage them anymore. With mild cognitive impairment, that ability to handle your money is pretty much gone. And 22% of people over age 70 have mild cognitive impairment, so we can see this would impact a lot of people. Frequently, when people lose that ability to manage their own money, they have a financial caregiver. We also would call that a fiduciary, someone with legal authority to handle their money. And that person has a great deal of access. That's why some people, for example, call a power of attorney a license to steal, because you're sitting in that person's shoes, you're handling their money, and you have a great ability to siphon off the money and not use it for their benefit and use it for your own benefit. We have such a large percentage, as you know, of residents in nursing facilities and assisted living who have cognitive decline. About half of nursing home residents have dementia, and about 40% of assisted living residents do. And as we mentioned, you know, financial exploitation may result in the person's rent or monthly fees not being paid, and then they may be subject to discharge or eviction, and then that becomes a really huge crisis. So let's move on to talking finally about the manual and what's in it. We designed the manual as a guide to help operators and staff protect their residents from financial exploitation through prevention and through early intervention. The guide is designed for administrators, business office staff, and social service personnel, because they were really the key audience we wanted to target, and any staff involved in admissions. But it could be useful to other staff as well, and clearly to other entities in the community, also in other residential settings. So we think the guide would have some applicability to senior housing and other kinds of congregate settings where older people live. And this last bullet here goes to how you can supplement the guide to make it specific to your state, and we'll come back to that later. So we like to say there are four pillars of successful intervention by facility operators, and of course this would apply to you and to others as well. And we really tried to come up with four R's, but we couldn't come up with an R word for prevent. So P is for prevention, and then we have three R's for response. So prevention is through awareness and training. And then the R's, recognize, spot the warning signs and take action. Record, it's important to document your findings. And then report, tell the appropriate authorities and trigger responses. And let's see a little bit more of what we're talking about there. But first, another poll question. True or false? Federal law requires long-term care facility operators and staff to report suspected financial crimes against a resident to the state survey agency and to local law enforcement. Okay, you are responding, and let's give it another minute. All right. Well, the great majority of you got this correct. The answer is true. And now let's talk a little bit about understanding the laws, both federal and state. So state laws are really going to be probably in some ways more important in this arena than federal laws, but it's important to know about federal as well. And the kinds of state laws that we're talking about have to do with defining what financial exploitation is, what are the reporting mandates, how does adult protective services work that can address these problems, and what are the criminal laws? If you get law enforcement involved, you know, what crimes will they be investigating and what kinds of prosecution can they do? And all of this will vary somewhat from state to state. So let's talk for a moment about adult protective services. There are a couple of threshold questions here in terms of whether APS can help in a case. And the first is whether the victim or the alleged victim is eligible for services. States vary in terms of how they define eligibility. So, for example, in many states, to get adult protective services, you must be an adult 18 or over who is vulnerable due to some type of cognitive or physical impairment. Now, in some states, it will be over a certain age regardless of disability. So they may have a law saying anyone who is subject to some type of abuse, neglect, or exploitation who is over a certain age, like 60 or 65, that on the basis of age alone, they will qualify for the services. Or some might have both an age criteria and a vulnerability or impairment criteria. Once the Adult Protective Services Agency looks at, are you in the right population, they will then look at, what is the allegation? What happened here? You know, is someone being accused of stealing something, or what exactly happened? And does that meet the state's definition of financial exploitation? If both of those things are true, Adult Protective Services should be able to then take the case and do an investigation, determine whether financial exploitation actually occurred, and if so, what services are necessary to protect and help the victim. So that's kind of in a very quick nutshell how the APS laws work. And then in terms of law enforcement, we have an array of criminal laws on the books. So these are usually not specific to elder financial exploitation. If there's a prosecution, it could be for theft, it could be for fraud, embezzlement, forgery, et cetera, some type of financial crime. In addition to that, some states have a specific crime of elder financial exploitation. Their legislature has wanted to define elder financial exploitation itself as a crime and to create penalties in terms of jail time, fines, et cetera. And then you also need to look to your state laws for reporting mandates. Usually state mandatory reporting laws, and most states have them, will either have categories of professionals who must report if they suspect abuse, or some states say any person. It's a blanket mandatory reporting. Any person in the state who sees something, who suspects that some kind of abuse, neglect, or exploitation is happening, must report either to Adult Protective Services, to law enforcement, or to both. And a little bit later in the webinar, Aaliyah will talk a little bit about mandatory reporting and how it applies to long-term care ombudsmen. Now, coming back to that federal requirement that we mentioned before, as you know, since you answered correctly, there is a federal mandate that was in the Elder Justice Act that became part of the health care reform legislation that suspected crimes must be reported. It's to facilities that received $10,000 in federal funds in the previous year. The mandatory reporting requirement is that they report within 24 hours unless it's a threat of serious bodily injury, and then more quickly. This has been defined as not applying to assisted living facilities. But we try to make the point in the manual that regardless of whether you're a mandated reporter or not, reporting is the right thing to do. So moving on to warning signs of financial abuse, we have a few examples on the screen here. It's important to note that these are signs that may indicate that financial abuse has occurred, but it doesn't always indicate that. So obviously more investigation and more knowledge and more care has to be taken, but it's very helpful to have sets of red flags. And in the manual, we have grouped them in categories. So for example, some of them are things that a resident may tell you or tell the facility staff, things that you see in the person's room or apartment, things that you see in family interactions and so forth. So we have them by categories. And then you just see here kind of a smattering of them, whether it regards to possessions disappearing, interactions that you might see, or someone telling you that they're pressured to make a decision about something quickly. You see somebody new around who didn't seem to be in the person's life before and now seems to have a lot of authority to handle the finances. Unpaid facility bills, very important, especially in the context of the manual, because so many of these cases do arise where that's really the first sign that you may not be familiar with the person's finances, but when the bill is going unpaid for, you know, a month or two or three or four, and sometimes these go for a long time, you know, that should be a real red flag, and so forth. So there are lots more in the manual, and take a look and see what those are. So let's move on to one more poll question. And this is a fact or fiction. A facility discharge notice is required before facility staff may report suspected financial abuse to APS or law enforcement. So does anyone think that a discharge notice has to go out first? Okay, almost all of you got this one right. This is not a condition precedent to filing a report. In fact, just the opposite. You know, there isn't any precedent except for suspecting that it has occurred. But this is a misconception that does, or misinformation that gets out there occasionally. So now let's move on to the section in the guide that provides a model response protocol for facilities. In developing the manual, we were hopeful that sort of creating a how-to would encourage facilities to set up a systematic way of responding to these situations. And I've certainly found that the more you can do for people when you want them to respond in a certain way in terms of creating materials, creating protocols, and so forth, the more likely it is that they'll actually do what you're hoping to encourage. So we have tried to lay out in some detail a model response protocol that they could take and adapt to their facilities. It's based on a team approach, and in that section we talk about forming a standing team in the facility. We suggest who might be members of that team, someone from the business office, an administrator, a social worker at minimum, and the purpose of a team, which would be to act timely when suspicions arise. We urge them to investigate and record what they find as soon as warning signs appear. So the trigger could be an account that's delinquent for 60 days or whatever standard they set up. We talk about documentation by appropriate staff. We want to make sure that people don't overlook some staff that may not really be viewed as direct care staff. So frequently housekeeping or maintenance or other personnel of that sort may witness a lot of things and may have important information, so don't overlook them. Don't just go to your direct care or just your professional staff. We encourage them to advocate for the vulnerable resident, the importance of talking separately to the resident, you know, in a quiet, private setting, understanding that they may be reluctant to explain anything or share information with you because they might, especially if it's a family member or a close friend, they might fear retaliation. They may feel shame. They may feel sympathy for the family member. And these are all reasons why these cases frequently don't get reported by the victims, which is unfortunate. It's understandable, and we have to figure out ways to get around that. We do encourage the facility teams to get the long-term care ombudsman involved. Again, we want them to be sure they understand the reporting requirements, whether they're a mandated reporter, who they must report to. And then we talk about reporting. You know, the report should include who, what, when, where, how. And we encourage them to request an investigation. We also say that follow-up can accomplish a lot. And we do say in the manual that it's not true. You must give an eviction notice before reporting. We also talk a little bit about frequently when facilities do the right thing or when individuals do the right thing and report, they get frustrated because they never hear anything back. They don't get information. They don't know where their investigation went. And that can be frustrating, and it can make them get very cynical about why should I report? I don't know whether anything ever happens. APS doesn't do anything. The police don't investigate and so forth. Some of that is because of confidentiality. So as a reporter, you don't necessarily have access to information about what happens afterwards. So we really want people to persevere, even though they might not always get the feedback that they would like. Frequently, that's for a good reason, and it doesn't mean that nothing is happening. And then we talk a little bit about additional avenues for action, depending on what the problem is. We list different federal and other state agencies that might be entities that you'd want to reach out to, depending on the facts of the situation. So moving on to one more poll question, and this is, think in your head, the sentence. In my experience, facility staff are afraid to confront family members about suspected financial exploitation because, one, they view family members as their clients. Two, it's really hard to confront someone about suspicions of wrongdoing. Three, both of the above, or don't know. Okay. Well, you're all right in that you've all said that at least the first two, one of the first two choices is true. And almost all of you have agreed that both one and two are true. And I could see how those answers would both resonate with you. So you guys are doing great. You already know a lot of this. That's awesome. Okay, just one more slide here in terms of the content of the manual and the whole kind of program that we're trying to lay out here. And this is the prevention section. So the guide talks about prevention through sort of a multiplicity of strategies. The first one is staff orientation and training, and we give some ideas in the manual about inviting local law enforcement ombudsmen like you, Adult Protective Services, and other agencies in the community to come into the facility and help with that orientation and training. Certainly, they're the experts. They can give a lot of specifics about what people need to know. What are the scams that are going around right now? How does it work when you report in our state and so forth? So great to bring those folks in to help facilities. We have a long list of topics that should be covered in the training. We suggest using two other sets of materials that the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, my office, has put out, and I'll talk about them a little bit later. That's Money Smart for Older Adults and the Managing Someone Else's Money Guides. And we also encourage facilities to put on similar programs for residents, for families, and for resident and family councils. Then we talk a little bit about facility policies and practices. We give them tips for things to share with new residents and families on the first day of admission. So they need to share with them policies on late or missed payments, policies on theft of personal property, If the family member or friend is a fiduciary, like an agent under a power of attorney or a Social Security representative payee, we encourage the facilities to ask for documentation of that so they can have it on record that that person is authorized to handle the money. Then we have a little box on asking about exploitation versus confusion. Sometimes something that might look like financial exploitation really isn't. So even though our main purpose here is to raise consciousness about exploitation, you also have to learn some discretion about what's really going on with this resident and with the family. Sometimes it's an overwhelmed family member who just is not on top of it, cannot get it together to get the payments in on time, is having trouble with a Medicaid application or any number of other things, dysfunctional. We encourage them to make those distinctions and to support those overwhelmed family members in different ways for the benefit of the resident. And I'm sure you folks run into this a lot. And then we talk a little bit about scams that target older people. We talk about how they're always changing. Some of the scams take advantage of people's memory loss or their fear that they have memory loss. And so, you know, they may try to convince people that they agreed to do something they really haven't agreed to do. We have a table in the guide that has a list of different scams. We talk about warning signs that a resident has been scammed, and so forth. So we try to have some generic hallmarks of scams in addition to the specific scams like, you know, lottery scams or romance scams or the grandparent scam and all the other ones that are going around. So that gives you pretty much of a chapter-by-chapter sense of what is in the manual. And now I would like to turn it over to Iris Freeman, who's going to talk about the Minnesota experience and as well as tips on how you might take this guide and adapt it to your state.
Well, thank you, Naomi. Thank you, Aaliyah. I hope my voice is coming in from this distance.
It is.
All right, thanks. By reintroduction, I am a social worker who teaches in a law school. I teach elder justice policy, but most pertinent to this afternoon, I'm a first-generation ombudsman. I worked as a regional ombudsman in a seven-county area around the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul in the late 70s and early 80s, in the last century, I might say. And so that's very much a thread in the work on the manual. It comes out of that background. So a little more about the background on the next slide. The actual work began with the Vulnerable Adult Justice Project, and the project since 2007 has been an advocacy collaborative that meets on a routine basis each month to improve resources and systems for vulnerable adults in Minnesota. And the stakeholder group includes people from law and law enforcement, health and health regulation, health providers and health regulators, ombudsman, AARP, Adult Protective Services, 40 agencies and associations in all. Our first legislative initiative in 2009 had a particular emphasis on financial exploitation and improving state law in that area. And the facility providers who came to testify in support of these laws offered up many, many examples of their frustration with exploitation of their residents. No, I think what they were saying was unpaid bills, which they had come to learn too late was financial exploitation of their residents. And as I listened to these facility examples, all I could think, well, one of the things I thought was, well, this isn't anything new. We were dealing with these cases from the very, very dawn of the Ombudsman Program. And so it seemed to me that once those laws were passed and once the session was passed, we needed something in the educational arena to deal with this, and our program at school sought a grant to develop a short manual for facilities in our state, and the project dates for that work were September 2009 to June of 2010. And certainly as we began, there was a great deal of enthusiasm for the product that was going to find the solution. There were really two goals on the next slide, two very basic goals, and that was to keep these varied perspectives in the Vulnerable Adult Justice Project working on this particular question so that we might at last reach some consensus on best practices for preventing and responding to financial exploitation in congregate care settings. And then out of that, to write a broadly endorsed manual and protocol with resources that people could use, something very, very practical that would become realistic because so many people, so many different points of view had decided that is the best way to go about it. Let me say something about the methods on the next slide. We started, now remind you I'm a teacher, with a literature search, and we searched, and we searched, and we searched, looking for best practices for healthcare facilities. Well, it was nearly a void search. There were very, very little that dealt with nursing facilities at all, with the exception of a few local tip sheets and checklists that had been put together by, well, there's no poll here, so I'll tell you the answer. It was local ombudsman or state ombudsman. And so there was very little to draw on but that and but some materials that had been developed for doctors, very, very little. And a lot more has come in the last years. As part of the work, we organized and invited people to participate in focus groups, facility trade associations, adult protective services, ombudsman staff and volunteers, elder law and health facility lawyers. Well, that was a good deal of repartee in one focus group because they didn't necessarily agree with one another, and law enforcement and prosecutors, local, county, and the Attorney General's office. But wait, there's more on the next slide. Research assistants and me, individual and small group interviews with the State Unit on Aging, area agencies, bankers, the Association of Guardians and Conservators, licensing agencies, regulators, labor union representing facility workers who were introduced to us by their organization. And out of all of that, we were able, after multiple initial drafts, to organize content around those themes of prevention first, knowing the warning signs, documenting what are the suspicions and reporting, and most of all, coordinating the work within the facility, because so often what was going wrong was that the left hand didn't know what the right hand was doing, the business office, the social services and the administrator's office were on separate wavelengths, let's say. But then the best eventual draft was disseminated to all of these groups for feedback and consensus building. We went through several rounds of that before the final manual was completed and was disseminated to members by our two facility trade associations in the state. So just quickly, let me say something about what the focus groups took on. After we got ourselves settled, the questions that were the core of the discussion were for the members of the participants to describe their pertinent experience, the practices that have led to successful outcomes in their cases, the barriers and frustrations, the kind of guidance that would make the tool we were developing practical for them, and further recommendations, and then we would just summarize and commit to keeping people in the loop as we moved forward. Well, what did we find? Next slide. there was still enthusiasm, but there was lots of frustration, lots of finger pointing among providers, adult protective services, and ombudsman, a lot of misunderstanding about what the others are supposed to be doing, but very clear agreement about what should happen, which is protecting the resident from further loss and from especially loss of housing and medical care. Well, as Naomi mentioned earlier, not only were there urban myths, I should say, they were rural myths too, because it was, after all, Minnesota. And one of the frequent ones we encountered, oh, the police won't take a report unless the resident is discharged, so we have to put her on the front step. Well, no. And we also encountered many problems that needed broader advocacy, legal issues such as power of attorney laws, and systems issues such as counties doing everything their own way that are kind of immune to a best practice manual for facility. But they were problems that we flagged that absolutely had to be dealt with in the longer term work to come. So let's talk just briefly about state-specific manuals and tips for adapting the CFPB national manual for your local area. And I would hope that especially the state ombudsman among this audience and in your lives will take a leadership role in that work. First of all, because the CFPB manual is national, there are no state-specific descriptions and citations of necessary terms, laws, and systems. So everything on this list, the definitions for elder or vulnerable, the definition for what constitutes financial exploitation, whether there are criminal code provisions or enhanced penalties, whether there are civil financial exploitation laws in your state, what the mandated reporter obligations are, whether there's immunity for good faith reporting. It's very important to be able to guarantee that as you're training people to report, and where the reports are filed or called in or logged in, as well as agency jurisdictions. So many of the confusions and frustrations we found were due to individuals not understanding either the breadth or the limitation of an agency's jurisdiction. So those are all important. Next slide. We would also recommend the state-specific guides look at, well, what are the applicable state laws around findings and consequences or other guidance that you can find on data issues and appeals? Are there nursing home or assisted living admission contract laws that play a part here, and are there specific laws about accounting for and protecting residents' personal fund accounts or other kinds of valuables that are stored by facility staff? Finally, next slide, please. We would recommend that as the national guide provides basic information about all of these services that a state-specific guide would have much more complete information about state and local numbers for all of these, ombudsman, adult protective services, et cetera. So let's just go to the next slide. As part of the history of the Minnesota Manual was that it evolved out of a group, it certainly comes to mind for the manual designers at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, as well as those of us in Minnesota who have done a local guide, that a local summit or collaboration is very, very valuable in trying to get people to agree about what best practices are. And so potentially there's a local summit or collaboration in your future, either to adapt the manual or for ongoing professional networking, as the Vulnerable Adult Justice Project has been. Now, if there's already such a collaboration that's begun, then This is just one more call to get involved. And if there hasn't been, then you can be the spark. But one person can be only a spark. One person cannot be a committee. Don't try. Ask me why I, you know why one person can't be a committee. But in any case, the small organizing committee can begin by agreeing on a purpose, setting the date and time, identifying the agencies to invite, identifying a convener or facilitator and recorder, and finding an accessible, comfortable, free location. Let's go to the next slide. And so I would, as we did with our focus groups, as you begin or take on work to make what is a national guide state-specific and to develop working relationships in the bargain, plan for a two-hour stakeholder meeting, include simple refreshments. Food is so important, and so is hydration, I mean water. Have a clear purpose statement in the invitation. Cast the net widely for people to invite people and organizations. And then again, as we did with the focus groups, spend a little time getting started by focusing on the purpose, which is resident safety. The purpose, if we're talking about facilities and finances, can begin to sound like it's getting bills paid. But this is not bill collecting, and ombudsmen aren't bill collectors. And the phone is muting, or I certainly hear a lot of sighing about that. But that's what you want to do. Focus on resident safety. Share experiences. Share wins. Share frustrations. Wrap it up and keep people involved. And so as I fade into the sunset here, let me pose the final poll question. And that comes on the next slide. A lot of this focus has been on the role of families in financial issues concerning nursing home residents and assisted living residents. What do you see as the biggest problem with family members who manage money for someone else? One, that they steal or misappropriate money. Two, that they don't know how to do the right thing. Three, that there's little or no oversight of their work. And four, it's all true.
Okay, this is Naomi again. I'm going to jump back in here because I don't think Iris can see these results. So almost all of you agree with the response I would have made, which is all of the above are true. So why did we ask this question here? Why did we circle back to this? And this is kind of a segue to just telling you really quickly about those other free CFPB Office for Older American resources that I mentioned before that I hope some of you have seen already. But if you haven't, we're going to tell you where to find them, and we hope they will be useful to you and to your ombudsman program, et cetera. And the first one is Money Smart for Older Adults. Money Smart is a series of financial education curricula that the FDIC, which is another federal financial regulator, created over the years. And when our office got going, we thought it would be great to have one specifically for older adults. So using a train-the-trainer model, this is an instructor-led training curriculum about elder financial exploitation and planning for, you know, potential emergencies and so forth. Probably what's most important to you, although it would be great if some of you wanted to become trainers and you can contact me about, you know, how you might be able to do that, but we have a participant guide, and it just walks through all of the basics about frauds and scams and financial exploitation. It gives examples. It tells people what they need to know. It's actionable. It has sort of self-evaluation quizzes and so forth. But it's just a good primer on elder financial exploitation. And that's available. You can download it. You can order it in bulk, et cetera. And that would be a great thing also if you're working with facilities that want to do any of this training and these educational programs we talked about. It's a great resource that they could use. Secondly is the Managing Someone Else's Money Guides. These are for what we like to call financial caregivers, people not professionals, family members or friends who are helping an older or a disabled family member who can no longer pay their own bills or can't make financial decisions. And these are people with legal authority, so we're talking about guardians of property, we're talking about agents under powers of attorney, we're talking about representative payees and VA fiduciaries, and we're talking about certain kinds of trustees. What the guides do is walk them through their duties. We take sort of complicated legal responsibilities and put them in plain English. We have four duties. We walk them through them. We make them understand how this applies to actual real day-to-day life. Then we have a section on how they can guard against scams and financial exploitation. So we give them a lot of the basics that we've talked about today on this webinar and that we also repeat in the Protecting Residents Guide, and we tell them where to go for help. They've been really popular. We were really lucky. Dear Abby, working with the federal government, disseminated a family caregiver kit. It included these five CFPB publications. Once the Dear Abby column was published on this, they got requests for 75,000 of them within a day. So that tells you Dear Abby has a lot of reach out there across the country, but it was a great way for us to get these materials out. So next slide. This is just a little graphics here that shows you what the Managing Someone Else's Money guides look like. Like the other Protecting Residents guides, it's green. That's our branding. Moving on, the Money Smart, that's the logo for Money Smart for Older Adults. That one we're able to make blue because that's the FDIC color. And moving on to the next slide, I guess everybody will get these slides afterwards, so you don't have to try to write down these links, but you can download them directly from our website, and you can also order the hard copies in bulk through the link that we have on there. They're free because they're federal government publications, so we hope you'll all take a look at those. And finally, this is just our contact information. I think I can speak for both of us. I hope that we would love to hear from you if you have specific questions that we don't get to answer at the end of this webinar, if you think we can be helpful, if you want to know how you can get some of these Money Smart trainings or, you know, trainings on all of this stuff out in your community, please reach out to us. IRIS is a wealth of information from the state perspective and through many long years of experience with the Ombudsman Program. So, again, we really appreciate the opportunity to do this today, and I will turn it over to Aaliyah.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you, IRIS and Naomi, for your excellent presentations. Now, I'm just going to take a couple moments to further discuss how long-term care ombudsmen can use this guide in their work. So one of the ways you could is to conduct an in-service training for facility operators and staff. So ombudsmen can work to make sure facilities are aware of the guide and offer to be a part of an in-service training on one or all of the suggested training topics for facilities that Naomi mentioned before, which are detailed in the guide. In these trainings, ombudsmen can outline the ombudsman role as resident-directed advocates and discuss how ombudsmen can work with facility staff and operators to combat financial exploitation. Ombudsmen can also offer to do presentations to resident and family councils around the topics included into the guide. Using the training topics found in the guide, they can educate family members and residents through presentations and facilitated discussions at the family and resident council meetings. Ombudsmen can use the case vignettes found at the beginning of each chapter in the guide as discussion starters and educate residents and family members on how to detect and report suspected financial exploitation using the tips and information found in the guide. Ombudsmen can also work with stakeholders such as Adult Protective Services, local law enforcement, etc., to develop a state-specific version of the CFPB guide. This guide could include the state-specific roles and contact information for the key players working to combat financial exploitation, as well as detail state law and reporting processes in the event of suspected elder financial exploitation. Lastly, another way that ombudsmen could use the guide is for in-service trainings for long-term care ombudsmen. You could use the advocacy tips and warning signs detailed to train fellow long-term care ombudsmen on how they can work effectively with facilities to combat financial exploitation. During the training, ombudsmen can discuss the long-term care ombudsman role in reporting suspected cases of abuse, neglect, and exploitation, and how to remain resident-focused while protecting confidentiality. Now, quickly, regarding ombudsmen as mandatory reporters, some states do have laws in which long-term care ombudsmen are included as mandatory reporters of abuse. However, the Administration on Aging says that this is a clear conflict with the federal requirements around confidentiality and disclosure, and has stated that state law may not require reporting of suspected abuse, neglect, or exploitation by the Long-Term Care Ombudsman Program, where such reporting violates the federal requirement that an ombudsman is prohibited from the disclosure of the identity of a complainant or resident without appropriate consent, pursuant to Section 712D of the Older Americans Act. In states where ombudsmen are listed as mandatory reporters, the state ombudsman should be working to remedy this conflict. Even if a long-term care ombudsman carries a professional license, such as a licensed social worker, and is considered a mandatory reporter under their professional license, the ombudsman must adhere to the federal disclosure requirements when acting as a long-term care ombudsman and cannot be required to report abuse without appropriate consent. The Long-Term Care Ombudsman Program is unique in that it was designed to ensure that ombudsmen serve as the agent of residents and help residents to achieve what residents believe is in their best interest. Long-term care ombudsmen should communicate with their supervisors when they receive an allegation of abuse and follow applicable state long-term care ombudsman program policies and procedures regarding consultation and communication. For more information on the topic of ombudsmen as mandatory reporters, including advocacy strategies and case studies, you can refer to NORC's Technical Assistance Guide for Ombudsmen entitled Responding to Allegations of Abuse, the Role and Responsibilities of Long-Term Care Ombudsmen. This guide is found on NORC's website on the Elder Abuse Issue page, which is linked on this slide. So now we are going to hear from Lisa Schifferle with the Federal Trade Commission, who is going to give you a brief overview of a new consumer education campaign aimed at older adults around the issue of scam prevention. Lisa?
Hi. Thank you, Aaliyah. Thanks to Consumer Voice and the CFPB for giving us a few minutes to talk about Pass It On, the FTC's newest educational campaign. My name is Lisa Schifferle, and I'm an attorney with the Federal Trade Commission and our Bureau of Consumer Protection. And I'm just going to tell you real quick about our new campaign called Pass It On, if you could move to the next slide, please. So what is Pass It On? It's aimed at active older adults, and it includes articles, presentations, bookmarks, activities, and a video, which are all designed to get older adults talking about scams and how to prevent them. Next slide, please. And a lot of market research went in to Pass It On before it was produced to look at what is the best way to reach older adults. And what we found was that older adults, not surprisingly, don't want to be treated as victims and want to be respected for their lifetime of experience. So that's what Pass It On tries to do. It treats older adults as part of the solution rather as victims and reinforces what they already know about scams, gives them tools to start conversations with their friends and family members, and pass on information to other people. It covers six different topic areas, which are listed at the bottom of this slide: identity theft, imposter scams, which is like phishing scams or if someone pretends to be from the IRS and asks for your personal information, those types of scams, charity fraud, healthcare scams, paying too much, which is really when people or companies cram additional charges onto your bills without your authorization or knowledge, and you've won scams, which are also known as lottery scams, where they say you've won a lottery, but just pay us some money first before you can claim the prize. So on the next slide, we talk about what is included. For each of these six topic areas, there's a one-page handout, and that one-page handout on the front, it talks about how the scam works. And what our market research found is that older adults in particular want materials that are very direct, to the point, and respectful. So These are very short tips. The first part of the page describes how the scam works. The bottom part of this page has what to do, and it's just two steps that you can take to avoid each type of scam there. And then on the back, it tells people how to report scams. And in the tips, it's often very respectful. It may say things like, well, you may not have been a victim of the scam, but you may know somebody who has been, so pass this on to your friends and let them know about the information. In addition to these one-page handouts, there's also bookmarks, because we were told that some people want, you know, only about 20 words rather than 100 words. So these bookmarks are for each subject area. They just have three very short tips of about 5 to 10 words each on how to avoid each type of scam. And then there are activities, usually word finds, word scrambles, or other word-related games on each of the topic areas. So the idea is that if you ever wanted to give a presentation to a family counselor or to facility staff, you could open with this brief 3-minute video that we have, and then you could have available the handouts and bookmarks and perhaps draw people in with the activities. The next slide talks about the demand that we've had. This Pass It On campaign was just released in July, and it will be publicly, officially announced September 9th. But even since July, our soft launch, there were 200,000 copies that were ordered in the first 4 weeks. And by mid-August, we're up to 280,000 copies. The types of groups that are asking for it are veterans groups, associations on aging, state and local government, nonprofits, social groups like the Red Hat Societies. We've had orders from 49 states and the U.S. territories, and we're still missing North Dakota. So if anyone out there is listening from North Dakota, you can be the one to bring in the first order from your state. But we are seeing a great demand for these publications, and we hope that you'll find them useful too. On the next page, it just talks about the principles of Pass It On, which are to start a conversation, share what you know, and you can get more information about the materials at ftc.gov/passiton or in Spanish at ftc.gov/pasalo or P-A-S-A-L-O. All the materials, like all other FTC materials, are free and in the public domain, so you can order copies in bulk for free in English and Spanish at ftc.gov/bulk order, or there also are links at the Pass It On website. Next slide, please. So this is just a really very brief overview about Pass It On. If you're interested in learning more, we are going to do a more in-depth presentation in conjunction with NCLC, the National Consumer Law Center. And it is open if you're interested in joining it on September 10th from 2 to 3:30 Eastern Standard Time. You can go to nclc.org and get more information and learn more about Pass It On in depth and about the scams that we're focusing on. Next slide. And since I know a lot of you are out there in the community and you may, either using these materials or just through your regular work, confront a lot of people who know about scams, we definitely want to hear from you. And so these are the phone number and the website to file a complaint with the FTC to report any frauds and scams that you're seeing in the community. It's 1-877-FTC-HELP and ftc.gov/complaint. In addition, feel free to email me at lschifferle@ftc.gov. That's L-S-C-H-I-F-F-E-R-L-E at ftc.gov. You're welcome to email me with any questions about Pass It On or if you have ideas about organizations that we should be reaching out to further about distributing Pass It On. But we hope that you will find it useful and be able to use it in presentations and handouts and pass it on to other people who you think could use it. So thank you.
Great. Thanks so much, Lisa, for letting us know about this fantastic new campaign and the resources. We're going to take the rest of the time we have for question and answer. So if you have any questions, feel free to place them in the chat feature, and I can read them aloud, or you can hit the raise hand button on your screen, and I'll call on you and tell you how you can unmute your line and ask your question.
And while you're getting geared up, this is Naomi. Lisa triggered one other thought that I wanted to share with you when she talked about the Spanish version of Pass It On. We are about to distribute Spanish language versions of the Money Smart for Older Adults and the Managing Someone Else's Money Guides. Those will be released in early October. So if you think that your population could really benefit for that, keep an eye out for that. We'll be posting a blog. We'll hope to get some stuff perhaps out on your listservs and so forth for folks who could make use of those materials in Spanish as well.
Okay, great. So we have our first question, which is, could you comment on undue influence? For example, when someone is ill and being cared for by someone and the ill person starts to give money to them, the elder has the individual autonomy to make that choice, but it seems suspicious when a helper benefits handsomely.
That's really a great question. I guess I want to give the caveat that I am not an expert on undue influence, but I share the recognition that, we really have a problem with defining what is somebody doing voluntarily or what are they knowingly consenting to. I mean, family members give each other money, they make gifts, they share resources all of the time. Where do you draw the line between, something that's voluntarily done and the person has autonomy and they're fully capacitated and so forth versus, when is it a crime because it's not really voluntary? And there's kind of that in-between area of where someone may still retain a lot of capacity, but they are vulnerable and someone else is exercising undue influence. So I guess my comment would just be to say, yes, this is out there. It's vexing. Different state laws on this are different. So I know California was kind of out front on undue influence. So in some places there may be a specific crime or there may be civil law provisions that would allow somebody to sue to be reimbursed for money that was taken. But it is a big problem. I think in your role as ombudsman, you don't necessarily need to know where to draw the lines, but when you see something like that where you think there may be some undue influence, I think that certainly could come under the category of things that you might want to report. How your own individual adult protective services or law enforcement agency is going to respond, I can't really predict. If you have more questions, if you want to email me offline, I can try to get some more specific answers to that.
This is Iris. If I could just add that, indeed, for adult protective services, for any investigators, drawing those lines can be very, very difficult, and the definitions will hinge on state law. But it is still all too often that we find that local law enforcement or even the judiciary will look at these cases once they get that far and say, oh, it was just a family matter. And so to the extent that recognizing that people do have the autonomy to make lousy decisions, where there has been that kind of pressure, that kind of deception, we want to do our best to advocate for those cases, not simply to be cast aside as, oh, just a family matter.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. So our second question is, can you please describe what proof or documentation people need to collect in order to get law enforcement involved?
Ooh. Hey, Iris, I'm going to throw that to you, maybe to make it a little bit more specific to experience in your state, if you
I'll try again, an area of considerable frustration, because when an individual, any individual, calls 911 or calls local law enforcement, we're not expected to be able to prove the case. We are simply expected to describe our good faith suspicions. And so to a very large extent, it's unreasonable for investigators in any of these offices to be saying, I won't look into it until you prove it for me. They are the finders of fact. But realistically, the more that we can provide about the people involved, and in the case of healthcare facilities, the vulnerabilities of the victim, who are all the players, and what are their relationships, and what are things that have happened, things that you have seen or documented or facility staff have documented, to that extent you will make it more likely that the case will rise to the priority level that it will be investigated.
I'll just chime in with one or two other things. In all too many communities, these elder abuse, and even when it's a financial crime, which sometimes could be more concrete than some of the other kinds of elder abuse or neglect, you know, these cases just do not get the attention. They do not get the resources. They're either looked at as family matters, or they're too difficult, or the person, you know, is cognitively impaired, so they won't be a good witness, or, you know, there are a million reasons for law enforcement or prosecution not to get involved. So I think kind of on a global level, we all just really need to keep doing this work, especially out there in the communities, to have these multidisciplinary task forces where you invite law enforcement and prosecution in. You can educate them. You can show them these egregious cases, and perhaps they will start picking up on them. There are some real leaders in the world of prosecution and law enforcement around the country who speak very persuasively. Some of you may have heard Paul Greenwood from San Diego. He does a great job talking about all of the myths of why these aren't good cases to bring, and he just ticks them off, you know, one by one. No, just because your client or the victim may not consent to, you know, pressing charges, or just because the victim may be cognitively impaired or even deceased, that doesn't mean you can't bring these cases and so forth. So, again, if you can bring some of these great speakers into your communities, perhaps they can really light some sparks among your police, your sheriffs, and your district attorneys and so forth.
And if I could just add one more thing to Naomi's very, very important point, it is that part of what holds law enforcement back is just lack of know-how in tracking money, and that's what makes these multidisciplinary teams and resources and specialist prosecutors so important, because, in fact, you know, none of us in our current roles, unless there's an accountant on the line, none of us is trained in that kind of accountancy in which we have to have the ability to analyze, first make and then analyze Excel spreadsheet after spreadsheet to be able to figure out exactly where, how the money flowed. And so even if time weren't an issue, and even if resources weren't an issue for local law enforcement, sometimes the biggest issue is they don't know how to deal with such complex cases.
Thanks, Iris. Just as a reminder, if anyone has any additional questions, you can place those in the chat feature or use the raise hand button on your screen. In the meantime, we had a participant ask if any of the materials are available in French.
Unfortunately, no, but if it's something you want, we can put it on the list. I don't know whether French is the highest priority in terms of the languages. I know that our bureau is certainly trying to do more in terms of translation, but Spanish always gets the first crack. Having just worked with my Hispanic colleagues on translating the Managing Someone Else's Money Guides, and I don't even speak Spanish, you know, it's hard because you have to really get the flavor. You have to try to keep the the level of language and the accessibility there and to get the concepts as they might be expressed in another language. So in the future, I'm sure we will get these out in more languages, but not right now.
And this, Lisa, the pass it on materials similarly are not yet available in French, only in English and Spanish, but some of the FTC resources are available in French, and you can go to ftc.gov/bulk order to find those.
Okay. So if we don't have any further questions, I'm going to go ahead and wrap up the call. Like I stated at the beginning of the webinar, we will be posting the recording and slides, which include all of the links to the guides and resources mentioned throughout the call, to the NORC website, and I'll be sending everyone an email once those materials are posted. So with that, I hope everyone has a great afternoon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
How many people are on there now?
Yeah, I wrote it down.